felt this stuff, that you guys hadn't done this stuff, that you were all weller than me and that I was some kind of pariah. And I used to try to, at different points, I would like try to manage the truth on my inventory because I wanted to manage an outcome, and also I didn't want you to think too badly of me. And I was robbing myself, and I didn't realize that, but I realized it after that experience with just the amount that I was capable of being honest about, for that being embraced and being loved and understood, and them sharing their experiences with me, that separation was gone. Because I was such a liar. And so it was a really beneficial experience to me. Now I'll swap inventory with just about anybody. It doesn't matter to me. I don't have much to hide. Reading inventory is a great experience. I haven't always had top-of-the-mountaintop experiences after reading inventory, but I have had them after doing step 6 and 7. What time is it? I'll say this about 6 and 7. You know, they don't spend a lot of time on step 6 and 7 in the big book, but those are profound, profound steps. That is where the magic happens. That's where the change happens. And I hate to use that word magic, but I'm using it anyway. Where I get changed. If there was anything more that I could do, they'd ask me to do it. But there isn't anything else I can do. All I can do is get ready to ask through the prayer and consideration, the directions that we have in there, and then ask. And I absolutely spend an hour. I don't rob myself of that. I tell the women I sponsor, don't rob yourself of that experience. Get down in there, man, with your Creator and have a conversation. And I go through all my fourth column in prayer with God. I'm talking and having a conversation. Some things will come to me that didn't come out to me when I was fist-stepping it. I'll write that stuff down. I've been brought to tears in that experience before. I have felt that connection strong. Just amazing things have happened in step 6 and 7. In 6, when I'm doing that review, and I'm really asking God to remove this stuff because I don't want to be the person who's capable of doing it. And I've also had the experience of going into that stuff and you know, having fist-step it, and I'm talking to God about it, and I know that I'm not ready to let it go. I know it. And I don't lie to myself about that anymore. I don't try to manufacture, because I think I should be, that I should be ready. I mean, I've seen the damage that it caused. I know it's wrong, but I'm not ready. I'm not done with it yet, and I know it. So I follow the direction. I ask God until I'm willing. And I don't try to make anything happen, you know, and then some people try to put the fear on you, which is, oh God, if you keep asking for the willingness, that means that fear and pain and suffering is getting ready to be visited on you. And that hasn't been my experience at all. If I am really willing to ask God to help me, and I know I'm not ready to take care, that ain't God's deal. That's on me. If I go out there and create more harm and suffering, that's on me, because I know at that point. And I know I'm not willing to let it go. And then there's the other side of this where I thought that I wasn't willing to let it go and it got removed anyway. So, you know, I can bring as much to this and think I know as much about what's going on there as I think I do sometimes. I don't know shit. You know what I'm saying? God is in charge of the spiritual life. In my spiritual life, and what's removed and when, all I can do is come to the table totally honest and willing and bring everything that I got to the table ready to go. That's all I can do. If there was more I could do, they'd tell me. If I could change myself, I would, but I can't. So I think it's time to stop. It's dinner time. Thank you. alcoholic. And I've had a wonderful time this weekend getting to run around with Bernadette. My God, what a joy. Just a blast. And got to go play some last night with some folks and eat dinner and hang out and have some great conversations. And the meeting last night. The meeting was awesome. It was great. Really enjoyed hearing everybody's experience with 6 and 7. But thank you again for having me out here, and Tom and Juanita for having me at your home. It was wonderful to be there. And I'm like sad to leave you guys. I want to take Bernadette home with me. And she's coming with me, Tom. Taking her home. But just have had a wonderful time, and it's really nice, and Tom talks about this a lot, but we talk a lot about your family and Alcoholics Anonymous, and I definitely feel connected to the family that is out here. And thank you so much to Adam and Bernadette. She hasn't heard that song yet. She needs to hear that. For just taking me out last night, and it was great. Thank you. And the Roadrunner, he's here this morning. There he is, hiding out over there. So it's good to see him. That's your spirit animal, man. Tasmanian devil, that's right. I just had a great time. So thank you so much for making me feel welcome and a part of. So, I tell you, if you missed the meeting last night, they really expanded on 6 and 7. You need to talk to them because it was good. There was a lot of just tremendous experience shared. So I'm not going to talk too much about that. I'm going to talk about 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 since we just have a couple hours. After I had written inventory and fist-stepped that and done 6 and 7, I was not allowed to... And that's probably not the right way to say not allowed. It was made very clear to me that I was to get started on amends immediately, that it wasn't something that I could wait around and do. And I was in pretty bad shape, so I knew that that was true. I had a lot of amends, especially financial amends, and that was overwhelming to me. The amends that I had to make to people at that time and at that place didn't bother me too much. I wasn't too concerned with that. It was the financial stuff that I couldn't... I think I was making $12,500 a year in my first financial amends list. I think I was close to 50 grand. And I couldn't even conceive of starting to make that right. And, you know, all the principles that we need in order to make amends and to make effective amends are contained in our big book, and also why we make them. And I was reminded of that over and over again when I wanted to balk at making them, which is the reason I'm making them is to be fitted so I can be of maximum service to my fellows. That's it. And that's the best life I've ever known, too, by the way. So I was ready to be fitted, even though I was afraid. I was very afraid. And until you've experienced the other side of it, going into something like that, when you don't know what's going to happen and you don't understand how it's going to work out, and people tell you, well, just trust the process. Just trust God. And you're like, well, I'm not feeling that. I'm not feeling it today, but okay. So, and I got reminded over and over again, you were willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. This is where the rubber meets the road. Are you ready to get out there and start cleaning up the wreckage of your past? So, with financial amends, I owed a lot of money. I didn't want to pay it back. My best thinking was, I'll save up. And then I'll pay it back all at once. That makes sense to me. My sponsor said, absolutely not. You took it out of the world. You're putting it back into the world. I don't care if you have to pay $5 a month. You pick one and get started. And that's what I had to do. So I picked one, called them up. I made the best arrangement I could. Sometimes I could only send $1 a month because I was paying rent, car insurance, you know, just our regular bills. I wasn't living large on, you know, $13.5 or $12.5, whatever it was. Writing that check every month was very difficult. I didn't like it at all, and it was humbling. I was embarrassed. I was I was more embarrassed than anything else because I thought I should be able to pay it back all at once. But it was just what my ego needed. It was a very smashing exercise for me because I was somebody for a long time who defined myself by how much money I had. Or not that I ever earned it. I just took it from you. But it was mine in my head. So that's how I defined myself. So it was pretty humbling. An interesting thing happened. The more money I started to pay back on those financial amends, the more money started coming into my life. And I would have never, ever believed that to be true for someone like me. Ever. And it didn't happen right away. It was probably a good 8 to 9 months into it. But I started making more money. I wasn't allowed to keep the money. It was strongly suggested by sponsorship that money goes right back out. I didn't get to keep it and go shopping or anything else. I had to pay it back. And I started getting different jobs, better jobs, jobs that on paper someone like me shouldn't have. I had just gotten my GED. I am not educated still today. I don't have a formal education. And I do fine. I'm doing all right. And it took me 5 years to get all of that money paid back. And there were some financial amends where places that I had stolen from were no longer in business. I had to find somewhere and give that money away. If I went to somebody and said, I took this from you, I was wrong, I stole this money from you, I'm ready to pay this back. And they said, no, don't worry about it. I couldn't keep the money. I still had to give it away somewhere. I wasn't allowed to keep that. Which I tried to, explain to my sponsor how it wasn't a big deal. And really, they were okay with me keeping it. And I got the usual laugh and give it away. It's not yours. Give it away. And then now it's become easy for me. And through that process, too, I lost attachment to money. I like money, but I'm not attached to money. I better be careful what I say with that. Then God's going to, strike me poor or something, right? But I learned how to live without it, which was a really valuable experience for me. It was part of me growing up. So that amends was benefited while I was getting straight with the world. What that did for me as a human being was tremendous. Just getting out there and cleaning up the wreckage of my past, even though amends are not about me, the change that wrought in me for me being willing to do that was huge. My family did not want to talk to me. They did not want to hear my amends. My mother especially. And she was like, I just don't want to hear about everything that you've done. She'd already been hurt enough by me. And she was someone who thought that I'd be dead before I was 21. So the fact that I was sober was just enough. And Don was sponsoring me at the time, so the direction that I got was, you need to start showing up at your parents' house on a regular basis. So that's what I started doing with my mother and my stepfather. And they were living in Stafford, Virginia at the time, so they were about an hour away, so I would start showing up regular. I did bring laundry with me, but that's okay. Make use of that time. But it gave my mom an opportunity to see that that I really was trying to live differently, and that it was consistent, because she'd seen me get sober before and be crazy. So to her, yeah, you're getting sober, whoop-de-doo. You know? Whoop-de-doo. You know, and this truly is about change. And she just needed to see that demonstrated for quite a while. And she was always, I never realized how on guard my mother was with me. I had her on eggshells most of the time. She was just waiting for the evil Valerie to show back up. And she told me that one time, because I started to get huffy at something. I mean, and I didn't see it until I saw that reaction of her just totally backing away and saying, "Oh God, you know, are you getting ready to show up now?" I can't remember how she said it, but it was like, that's what she was saying to me. And I was like, wow, I had no idea. Because it was my mom's fault I was screwed up. You know what I mean? I've been walking around with that belief for years. It was my mom's fault. My stepdad raised me, and he was a pilot in the Navy, and he was a tough guy, very tough guy. And he's an alcoholic. He's an active alcoholic today. And very tough man. Him and I did not get along when I was growing up. What's interesting, though, is when I was put in treatment in 82... he was the one who took me. And I think he really cared but didn't know how to demonstrate that. And of course, if you don't love me the way I think you should love me, then it means nothing. You know what I mean? But anyway, so him and I had he's just not an emotional guy. And he's very hard. And he's kind of mean. He's kind of a mean-spirited guy. And very unhappy. Anyway, so I made my amends with my mother, and I made my amends with my father. That was the beginning. What has happened since then is my family's been through a lot of stuff. And I have become, this is what my dad called me. He called, you are the stalwart in this family. I didn't even know what that meant. I had to go look it up. Because I'm not educated. And my stepfather is a very, very smart man. He's got 5 master's degrees, was invited to be a Rhodes Scholar, very intelligent man. And he was always very disappointed that I didn't go to the Naval Academy and didn't fulfill my potential or whatever. Yeah, I'm cursed with potential, right? Speaking of that, you know, I was listening to Jerry Elkins a couple weeks ago at a retreat, and he was talking about, you know, how everybody was always having conversations about him and his potential and how it was being wasted. And I don't know any alcoholic who hasn't heard the potential lecture. You've got so much potential, and you're wasting it away. Why don't you take that energy and just apply it, you know? We apply it, but, you know, not in that way. Alcoholics are very strong-willed people. We are not weak-willed people at all. It just has to be important to us. But anyway, so just through the years, as a result of being present for my family, telling them the truth, showing up on a regular basis, calling them every week, regardless of whether I wanted to or not, they're part of my Sunday morning ritual. We started developing a relationship, and they started seeing that I'm sober. When I'd go to visit, you know, sometimes people would travel with me. They started getting exposed to people that I run with in AA. They saw that my son wasn't completely goofy and being, you know, destroyed anymore. You know, so they started seeing some stuff. So they started being able to trust me. As a result of that, of just being willing to take those actions and not sit around and wait and go, where's mine? You're not treating me right now. I've been able to be a member of my family and relied upon in my family. So my family's been through a lot in the last year. My grandfather passed away, and I was called out there by my father. And that's when he told me, "You're my stalwart." My father was drunk the entire time. I drove him around everywhere he needed to go. I didn't try to change him. I accepted him exactly where he was at. Told him how much I loved him. And him and I, and the only time that he can get speak anything emotional or with some degree of honesty is when he's wasted. When he's not, when he doesn't have all that fear in the way. And I helped him make all the phone calls with my grandfather, and that's his last parent, and he's devastated by it. He loved his mother and father. And I got to hear a lot of stories about my grandfather, who is a World War II veteran and a paratrooper, and my son has his namesake, like my father and my brother, and my stepdad, I call him my father, whatever. He raised me. So just being able to be present for that and be a part of that was the biggest gift in my family. Shortly afterwards, I get a phone call from one of my brothers. He's drunk. And we've had many of those phone calls, you know, the drunken dials and playing music into the voicemail and the stuff I used to do when I was stalking people, you know. When I was a stalker, I'd do that. I'm a recovered stalker. But that's what my brother, he's drunken dial, you know, drunken dial, and, you know, and he plays South Park into the voicemail, too, and whatever. He used to be a police officer, left, was a Marine, and then a police officer, and he left the force, and, never give an active alcoholic a lot of money, bad mistake, you know what I mean? He got a lot of money, and he went through it in a very short time, going to Vegas and drinking and party and stuff, and he's married now and has a little girl, and I start getting phone calls from Connie, and she's hysterical, so she starts speaking in Spanish, and I'm just like, I don't understand that. You got to calm down and speak English, you know. And Connie's calling, and what's wonderful is that they know we're members of AA, and they that they do call. That's the miracle of it. My brother and I are close, but we've gone through periods where, you know, he just disowned me and write me off. And I'd have to go back and make amends, and he just like, yeah, and hang up the phone and wouldn't talk to me for a year. You know what I mean? So the fact that they called was amazing, because he didn't want to hear about any of that AA crap. And so I get a call from him, and he drives cross-country from Palm Desert, California, out to Virginia, and he was with us for a month sobering up. So to me, that's being part of the family and being of service to the family, and that's as a result of making amends. And it's not about how it looks or how people respond at the time. I can't emphasize that enough. Sometimes I get hung up on, if you don't respond to me how I think you should spiritually, or how I think this should go, because I'm doing God's work, damn it, that the amends mean nothing, or whatever. And I think the impact of trying to clean up the wreckage of our past and be an available member to our family, regardless of who they are or where they are, what they're doing or what they're not doing, makes us available when they really need us. And that's what's happened in my family as a result of making amends. I also got the opportunity to sit down one night with my grandfather and my stepfather, and those two were crying, and they'd been drinking and all that stuff, and well, they weren't crying, they were talking about World War II. And I don't know if you've been around men who've been in the war. They don't like to talk about it at all. And my grandfather's a very closed up guy too. And they invited me to come sit with them. Couldn't believe that. And then they started telling the stories, and then they started crying. For those two men to cry in front of me was a huge gift. No one could show that kind of emotion around me in the past. If you did, I found your weak spot, and I'm coming after you. If I know what your vulnerability, you know what I'm saying. This coffee right here messed it up. It's like I can't move it fast enough. Anyway, but if you showed any kind of weakness with me, and I was drunk and sober for a long time, that's what I would use. People were not safe showing that in front of me. It was not a safe environment. I was not a safe environment. And for me to be a safe environment for those men was astounding. I couldn't believe it. And so I just started weeping too. So it was wonderful to be a part of. And then eventually those guys got all uncomfortable with their vulnerability, and it stopped. But that's okay. It was wonderful while we were there. And my biological father is a member of AA. Those weren't hard amends to make, because we understood each other. I owed him a lot of money, and I had to pay those back. He said to me, he goes, "I knew you were really sober when I started getting checks from you every month." I knew this wasn't a joke. When it kept coming month after month until it was done. And really, that's the key. Am I consistently showing up? I've had to make many, many amends since then. There are some amends that I cannot make because to do so would cause harm. And what I was directed with that was, you get to live with it. You don't go get to make amends to save your own ass. You don't get to do it at other people's expense. You get to live with it. So I got stuff that I'm living with. But it does get put to use with other alcoholics one-on-one. So there are some amends, too, that I'm just standing ready to make. I have no idea how I can make those right. I had called Don with one of them. I remembered when I was younger, my friend and I just went on a mail-stealing spree. We just went through this huge neighborhood and stole everybody's mail looking for money. And, I mean, we must have had 200, 250 pieces of mail. We didn't care. We were looking for money. And, you know, and there were bills, letters, checks, you know, all that, people's personal stuff. And this was ever before I ever picked up a drink, too. So anyway, I shouldn't say that. You know, I had a social drinking period, and that's when I used to take sips off my parents' drinks. I was in my social drinking period, when I'd have a sip off their rum and coke. But anyway, how do I possibly make that right? What do I do to make that right? I have no idea who those people are. I don't even know if the same people are living in that neighborhood. This was in Orange Park, Florida. I mean, I have no idea. And Don said, "I don't know when, I don't know how, but you must stand willing to make that amend. And you will know it when it's presented to you, the opportunity to make that right. Stand willing, be ready." So I haven't had an opportunity to make that right yet, but I'm ready and I'm willing. There have been people that I haven't been able to find, and it's the same thing. I'm ready. Whenever God sees fit, I'm willing to make the amend. I had a lot of amends to make with people, with friendships, people that I'd harmed along the way. Most of like my, for lack of a better way to put this, coherent amends have been in sobriety. I've done just as much damage sober as I did drinking. So I had a lot of, as I go along, cleaning up wreckage. And there have been people in sobriety that I've gone to make amends to who are like, I don't want to have anything to do with you. And this is stuff I did sober. And they're also members of ANA. And they're like, you stay over there. That guy, I told y'all a story on Friday night when I turned into a peacock raging maniac. That's one example. There's more, unfortunately. Stay away. You know, I'm glad you're sober and doing your thing, but I don't want anything to do with you. But, you know, thank you for doing what you've done. And we all know, because we've all grown up pretty much in the same way, you know, I can never go and say, I'm sorry. If I've harmed somebody, I have to go and say, I am wrong. I have harmed you. What can I do to make this right? And then being quiet and listening to what they have to say and being willing to do what they're asking me to do. I've never been asked to do anything outrageous. I just haven't. I just needed the willingness to go do it all and to get busy doing that. And once I started making amends, I had to immediately start practicing 10 and 11, 12. And that's what it says in our book. You know, as we're cleaning up the past, we start, you know, practicing steps 10 and 11 and 12. I love step 10. For me, and I love what it says in here too. There's some great stuff in here. Does anybody have any questions about amends or anything they want to share from their own experience? Don't be shy. Tom?
I used to like to take advantage of old ladies. I never knew that until I did inventory and saw the amount of old ladies I've taken advantage of. They were easy, you know. Mm-hmm. And I had taken some money from an older lady saying that I would provide a service that I never provided and build her something. I talked to Don about it. I said, you know, this lady got to be dead. She was like in her 70s, late 70s. Man, that was 20 years ago, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, and I said, I don't know where she lives. I know vaguely the neighborhood, but I have no idea. I don't know what her name is. I have no idea what her name is. They used to call her Tanti, which was half German. That's all I remember about her. She ran a little nursery school we used to call daycare.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, you've got to stay willing. That's what they said. You need to stay willing. And he said, there'll be something will happen. You'll find a bag lady or there'll be somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something will take place. And a lot of these people have heard this story and feel weird. A series of events in Gallon AA. I snapped at the street that she had lived on. Was the street that this AA lady lived on. I was giving rides to meetings. And I said, you know, this is just out of left field, but there was this woman 20 or some years ago named Tanti that I, you know, stole from, basically. And she goes, well, I don't think she's deceased, but I know her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just one of those things, you know, and I was willing to wait and I was willing to keep it alive, you know, and be willing.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I think I can get you in touch with her daughter. And I said, well, that would be great. At least the money can go someplace. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Thought, you know, this is terrific. And just that evening, I was driving up to pick her up to take her to a meeting, and as I drove up, the AA lady turns around and she goes, you're not going to believe this. This is Tanti's daughter. She just happened to walk up the street.
Wow.
Like this after, you know, just now.
Mm-hmm.
And her name is so-and-so. And anyway, I said, well, I knew your mom, and I need to, you know, kind of a long thing. But she said, yeah, come see me. We can talk, you know, and I did. And I explained the whole thing. Didn't want the money. I said, look, gotta pay the money. Gotta pay the money, gotta pay interest on it. You know, I just have to. And she said, well, that's your deal. She said, but my mom would have wanted it to go to something having to do with children and helping children. And I asked permission to go to her mother's grave, but not her mother's grave, because I do a lot of grave stuff always happen. And so that same day, I went up to the Rosario Cemetery. I found her grave, and I made amends for the grave, asked her forgiveness, and told her how wrong I was. And anyway, I went home, and in those days, nowadays we watch a lot of TV. Mm-hmm. Back then, we never watched TV. We just literally never hardly ever saw a television. Well, we never had time to. And the TV was on, and there was an advertisement for a camp called Camp Enchant, and it was down in Alamogordo, and it was for terminally ill children, like with cancer, who are definitely going to die. And this is like even 2 weeks at camp. So it's kind of a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you know, gee. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Know. And so anyway, I was, and then I had to like work to find them. That was a whole thing. But eventually paid the money, you know, to that deal. And I always do this. I always, when I'm paying to a charity or something, I have that charity let the person know that it was paid mm-hmm. in my name, so it's not just blowing smoke. And mm-hmm. So did that, and the whole thing was, you know, was put to rest. It was a beautiful thing.
That's awesome.
But the piece was like, just stay willing. Just mm-hmm. stay willing. And keep that one alive, and that's what God told me. Mm-hmm. That's what came to mind when you said that.
Yeah, that's key. You know, too, and you, if you're willing to make the amends, all kinds of opportunities will show up to do it. I remember one time I was driving to downtown Richmond to go to work, and I had been asking God to show me where I could put some money because I needed to give money away. And I was at the stoplight in downtown Richmond, and I looked to the left, and there's an old beat-up truck with the hood open, and this old man and this young gal there, and someone told me to go over there, and I'm on my way to work. So normally I'd be like, are you sure? You know, really? Because you know, we get talked to, we get direction from the Spirit, or I do anyway. Have to check it out with sponsorship sometimes, make sure it's not me talking. But anyway, so I drive over there, and their battery's dead, and I ask them, can I help them, give them a jump, and we do that, and their battery's in pretty bad shape, they need a new one, and I said, will you let me buy you a new battery? And he said, what's going on here? And he's just looking at me like stunned, you know, and, you know, what's this little whitey girl doing? And, so I said, you'll be helping me if you will let me help you. And wrote him out a check. I said, well, 50, 75, what do you need? He said, 50. I wrote a check for 50, left it blanked so he could go buy it wherever he wanted to, and left. But opportunities like that showed up all the time. I've got amazing traveling stories of running into people on planes that are going to help their wayward daughter and getting to talk to them about Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's happened to me several times. So there's always opportunities if we're open to people. And the thing that I have to remember, because I can sometimes close up because I get so busy, it's like, okay, this is just my time now, and I'm not seeing you, I'm not talking to you, you know, go away. And I will miss opportunities like that. When it is about, if you want to get to know God, get to know God's kids. It's easy for me sometimes to just shut off because I'm all well now. Does that make sense? I work with plenty of drunks. I'm all well now. I deserve this quiet time. I'm not going to talk to some sad pute sitting next to me. You know what I'm saying? So, and that's wrong. Selfish. So, this thought brings us to step 10 on page 84, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we clean up the past. We have entered the world of the Spirit. That's great. That's good news. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness in the world of the Spirit. So what's understanding and effectiveness in the world of the Spirit? Well, it's your personal experience. What is it for you? I can talk about what it looks like for me. And we've been talking about it all weekend. A willingness to be honest about who I am. A willingness to extend myself to other people, even when it's inconvenient. A willingness to be of service in all of my affairs. A willingness to admit when I'm wrong, and not being afraid of that. Not having to be right all the time. Stuff like that. To me, that's growing in understanding and effectiveness. My understanding of the world of the Spirit has changed from something that was pretty closed up and tight and rigid to something that's pretty open-handed and very compassionate. And I would imagine that that'll continue to change. Effectiveness. When I think of effectiveness, I think about how have I become more effective? Well, what I don't, today I do a lot more than what I did 5 years ago. I'm much more active in every area of my life today than I was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. With added responsibility, I've always been given the power to fulfill that. That's why I don't manage my life. Whatever I've been asked to do, I've always been given the power to do it. And it has looked really busy at times. And we were talking some about that, but I'll talk more about that. So, and it says it's not an overnight matter. It'll continue for a lifetime. Like we were talking about, there is no there. I will be wrong again and again and again. I will tell another lie. I will have fear again. I will get resentful again. I'm going to make stupid decisions again. But it's okay. I will be dishonest. I'll be selfish. But it's all right. And not that I'm consciously going out there trying to behave that way, but it's going to happen. And it's part of the human condition. You know, something that's interesting to me in the big book, you know, once you're past the first step, when you get to the bedevilments and then the third step, they refer to it as the human condition. And they were talking about in the meeting last night. You know, I don't like the human condition, so I need some alcohol. The human condition is really uncomfortable to me. Because I got this spiritual malady thing going on. So, continue to watch for these things because they're going to crop up. And then the directions are real specific. Go to God first. I don't like that. Because I want relief right away. My favorite place to find that is I'm going to pick up the phone and call somebody. And I can whine or I can try to gather an ally, get them on my side. You know, if I'm really upset, I'll try to circle the wagons and figure out how we can retaliate together and justify it. I don't want to go to God first. And I don't. That's not my natural response. It's not my, maybe one day in sobriety it will be, but it's still not my instant natural response. To me, this has taken tremendous practice and I still don't do it every time. But I'm much more willing to go to my Creator today if those things crop up than I was. And when you get a 10th step, Betty, that's a great exercise to do. I'm going through the steps with a group right now, and we just got through the 10th step. And so we all hooked up, and we were 10th step buddies together. And I ended up with one of the gals I sponsor, and she kind of annoys me. So I'm like, do I really have to be telling her when I'm afraid or I've lied, you know? She's probably going to use it against me later, you know. But anyway, you know, we put numbers in the hat, and she was what I do. So I'm just going to have to trust divine providence, right? It was a great experience. I had a great time with her. She's hysterical anyway, but just sometimes she annoys me. But I love her. She probably annoys me because she's a lot like me. You know, loud and full of crap. And so, But so getting it to step buddy, and when that stuff crops up, and what we do, we make an agreement. The first question is, have you gone to God? First question. Have you gone to God? Have you prayed about it first? And then if the answer is no, and we made an agreement to be honest about this, you get the click, which is great. And I don't want to be clicked, so I go to God first. Then I pick up the phone because I want to look good. I got to set the example, you know. But that's our agreement, because this is practice. It's practice. It's practice. These spiritual exercises, this spiritual discipline, it's a practice. I mean, you can't go to the gym one time and walk out of there, you know, cut and buff. You're going to have to show up on a regular basis. It's going to hurt. You're going to have to, you know, get a mean-ass trainer. And it's going to take time and lots of repetition and practice. And it's the same thing with spiritual muscle. So I don't get down or angry at myself or frustrated with myself if I'm not doing it perfectly or how I think I should be performing it. So anyway, I had a great experience with her in doing that. And that's the best way I know how to do it, is to start practicing it with someone until it becomes a habit. So now most of the time it's a habit. I'll go to God first. I still sometimes want to pick up the phone and call someone, but the directions are very clear. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. God, please remove this fear. If I know what I'm afraid of, then I articulate that. We ask God to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone. And that's a really clear direction. And quickly means quickly. It doesn't mean next week, next month, next year. It means right away. I don't like that direction either sometimes. I've had a couple experiences at work lately where my boss is like a type A personality cheerleader. And she's very... she's a girly girl, but like she trained with the Navy SEALs. So she's like, but let me do a little demonstration. She's like, she's a perfect like duality female. She's like, you know, like if you go in her office, it's all cute and touchy and feely, and she's a cheerleader, and oh, isn't that so cute? It's cuddly and wuddly and soft. I can't even do her voice, but she's got one of those, oh, that's a itty pie, you know. And then, but if you make her mad, man, the Italian comes out, and that little Navy SEAL wannabe comes out, and she's gonna give you the smack down. Something hadn't gone my way at work. I don't even remember what it was or not. But I was upset with one of the other managers, and they were not living by these principles. And my God, I'm bringing these principles into work, so I think everybody else should. And he should be able to admit when he's wrong and he's not doing it. So I go to vent, and then I just went on a tirade and started taking her inventory. Not a good thing to do. And walked away from that and was praying and called my sponsor immediately. And then I had to go back and clean that up and say, I was wrong. I should have never said that stuff. And it's not true. Even if it, you know, and I want to say, even if it is true, it's none of my business. You know, I wanted to throw that in there, but I can't say that. All I can say is, I was wrong. I had no business saying that. What can I do to make that right? And it's okay. We all get upset sometimes, you know. So. Yeah, she's something, man. She is a character. She is something. Truly. she's something. Very well, whatever. I could talk about her for a while. She's an incredible woman. Of course, I think I'm smarter than her, though. Let me just throw that in there. And I definitely think I could do a better job than what she's doing. I do. I'm not joking. And and I was and I, I was talking to Jerry about this stuff because this has been really important to me, steps 10, 11 at work. And, you know, I was talking to Jerry about this stuff, and he's like, kind of the last frontier with this stuff is really learning how to practice principles before personalities at work and at home when we're sober a little bit. That's really where that stuff starts to show up. And I've just had a heck of an experience this year with that stuff and literally having to practice this and bring it to work. Because I've been upset a lot because I haven't done things my way. And I've had to change my whole perspective, which is what we talked about some earlier about, you know, treat my job like I would treat AA. You know, get there early. Give it everything I've got. Stuff like that. But I've had to practice cease fighting. Cease fighting anything or anyone, even my own mind. Don, you throw that in there. I thought it was very apropos. Because I like to, you know, have little battles with myself. But to cease fighting. Because I like to be right and I like to fight. So to ask me to cease fighting is what an order. But that has been paramount. I've started to learn how to really pause and not respond right away. We were talking about some of that at breakfast or dinner. Or heck, I can't remember. I think at dinner last night, we were talking about pausing. We were talking about pausing and not reacting right away and taking time to get into prayer before I make a decision or before I go to somebody with something. Because I used to find a lot of power in making decisions based on emotion. I used to run my life based on how I felt. And AA is complete opposite of that. This isn't about how you feel. It's about what you do. Feelings are nice. They can be entertaining. It's not that they're not important. But who really cares? This is about what you do. Ultimately, this isn't about how I feel. Shoot, if this is about how I felt, there'd be days I never got out of bed. Ever. You know? Or I'd just be riding the roller coaster all the time at King's Dominion. Couldn't get me off of it. I like the way it feels. Okay. That's kind of a bad example, but you get it. It's the coffee. It says, you know, in these promises, the issue of alcohol has left. We react sanely normally, and we find that this has happened automatically. We'll see our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That's a miracle of it. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. And that's what's happened. Can you imagine a shrink saying to you, I'm going to help put you in a position of neutrality? It's not going to happen. Or good for someone like me. No human power can place me in that position of neutrality. No human power. So it's been done for me. God's done it for me. The obsession has been removed. The problem has been removed. And that's what's happened. I've never been sober this long. Ever. Never. Have no desire to drink. It really isn't about drinking to me today. I have had thoughts of alcohol, but it's like the merry-go-round. It just kind of goes by. It's not something that's entertained. Before, if I thought about drinking, I drank. So I have been restored to sanity. It's not a sane idea to me to drink. Alcohol doesn't bother me. I can be around alcohol. My God, when I go home to see my family, I'm surrounded by it. Doesn't bother me at all. And I don't need to change them either, which has been a huge blessing. Because I come from a long, upstanding line of drunks and neurotics. Who used to say that? Some guy used to say that. It's true. For me. Anyway, so I've been placed in that position in neutrality. I just have to stay busy, stay on the path. Sometimes I get off into the weeds, but I always get back on the path, stay on the path. You can make all kinds of mistakes here, but if your foundation is strong, you may get beat up quite a bit. But my experience has been that I haven't drank. Women that I've sponsored that have gotten off the path but have kept their foundation is still strong. They haven't drank, and they've been beaten up pretty bad by life, by dumb decisions, whatever. Decisions based on self have been through a tremendous amount. So I know you can go through a lot sober and not drink if you're on the path, even though you may get off in the weeds. Says here that it's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action. For me, what that looks like today, where it would be easy for me to let up is on prayer and meditation. I'm so accountable in every other aspect of AA that if I don't show up at my home group, I'll get 10, 12 calls, where you at? I could only ignore those for so long. You know what I'm saying? There's already so much accountability there. Where I can let up on it is on my spiritual exercises, my prayer and meditation. So I don't do that. And there's too much benefit for me today. Anyway, I used to hear people talking about with prayer and meditation that it was like breathing for them. That was a part of, they had to do it. It wasn't like that for me for a long time in sobriety. It wasn't if I miss my prayer and meditation, I feel like I'm going to, I can't live today. That was not my experience. It is today, though. If I am not spending some amount of time in that today, something's missing, and it's noticeably missing within me. So I guess that's progress, right? Maybe. That's all I've got to say about step 10. Does anybody else have anything they want to share about it?
My name is Tony Blankenship, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Tony.
I was so busy my whole life looking for everything to be dramatic. And I thought that if I didn't have a big blow up at work, or if I didn't have my girlfriend didn't break up with me, or I didn't throw something across the kitchen, or I didn't, there wasn't something dramatic, that I wasn't afraid, or selfish, or dishonest, or resentful. The only way I recognize resentment is if I'm turning deep red and my kids are coming. I didn't recognize these symptoms. And gradually over a period of time, through God's monumental patience, I'm sure, my sponsor has taught me, guided me, by asking me questions and getting me to look in places that are uncomfortable. Because not a day goes by that I'm not selfish. I think of myself every day without fail. I have not thought of a day that went by that I haven't went, but what about me? What do I get? I haven't had that day go by. And whenever I'm selfish, I'm usually afraid because I'm not going to get it. I'm not going to get what I'm thinking of, so I get afraid. And I'm practicing trying to tell them and say, here's the deal. Here's what's really going on. And I've got to the point where it's not even about, I'm resentful. It's like, if I get irritated at somebody and my heart starts to pound a little bit faster, I probably need to talk about it. I don't always. But what ends up happening is, as a result of me not talking about that, I think that if the emotions went away, if the emotions pass, that I don't need to talk about it. You know what I mean? If the angers went away, if that strong emotion of angers went away, then I don't need to talk about it. But it's still there. Because my book says that I don't have any more power over resentments than I do alcohol. But I can't make it go away. So I have to talk about it. Because eventually what will happen is I'm a bit undisciplined. And I can only not talk about it for so long, and then it's going to come out sideways. And absolutely the wrong place. Absolutely. That's been my experience. And that position of neutrality that comes, I think, from doing it isn't only with alcohol. Because I haven't thought of drinking in a long time. The position of neutrality, I think, that happens for me is that everything used to be so dramatic. Like something would happen, I mean, sober. It's like something that happens, oh my God, something happened! Or something didn't happen. Oh my God, something happened! Or I'm so happy. Oh my God, I'm so happy! Or I'm so sad. It was like everything was this like exponential emotion. Today, what ended up happening is that neutrality is, and when it's, I mean, in its purest form. Not that I can, and I can't manifest this. I can't make it happen. Right? Is that stuff happens and it's like, hey, check out what's happening. It's like I get to be an observer. You know what I mean? I don't have to be entrenched in it. And it's only come from, and my 10-step buddy is my sponsor. Like, that's the deal. Not to say that I don't do 10 steps with other people. I do. I have people in this room to do 10 steps. But, like, I'm notorious for not let, you know, I will not let you in a second. And the person who I've asked to guide me through this minefield of alcoholism, if I start to shut him out, I'm in deep crap. Mm. I'm in really deep shit. Mm. And so he's my 10-step. He's the one I go to. That's who I call every week. Well, you know, I try.
In theory.
I try. Sometimes life, you know what, life happens. You know what I mean? But he's the one I tell on myself. Like, he's the one I tell. I'm scared to death. You know, we're going to call her my girlfriend. My girlfriend, we're buying a house together now. And the only way we can do it is if we put our money together. Like, I meant like a bank account together, with our bank account. And she made a comment the other day. She's like, well, we don't really need to do that for them. And what I hear is that I'm not going to do that. I just got so afraid, and it was like, you know, what's happened as a result of this thing is I got to tell her. I didn't just have to get upset and be like, I'm not talking to her, and hang up the phone. I just told her, you know what, I am scared to death. I'm afraid this isn't going to work. I'm afraid you don't want to do it. I'm afraid you're going to leave me in the dust, and, you know, like, I'm just scared. She's like, it's okay, I love you. And it was like, I got to do a little 10-step with my partner. that's like, way
awesome.
I just thought of something about it. Mm-hmm. That John used to say that I've been thinking a lot about lately, and has to do with the 10-step. He said, in my previous life, I was a reactor to life. Mm-hmm. Now I've become a responder.
Yeah. Beautiful. Beautiful way to put it. And that is what happens to us. Yeah, we stop reacting, start responding. I'm going to turn this off. That I stop her. I'm like, I'm not making you do anything, honey. This is what we do here. If you want what we have, then go do what we do. I'm not making you do nothing. Because she's got to take responsibility for her own recovery and not do this because she's being made to do it, like she's being oppressed by AA or sponsorship. That is not what this is about. If you want what we have, then you do what we do. I wanted what Don had, so I did what he did. I want what Jerry has, my sponsor today, so I do what he does. I want what they have, I do what they do. Nobody forces anything on me. What alcoholic responds to that anyway? We're not going to do anything unless we want to do it. Do y'all want to start talking about 11 and 12, or do y'all want to take a quick break and then come back and talk about 11 and 12? And more. Let's break. again, I have been wonderful at times following those directions and very consistent. And at other times, I have been incredibly lazy and refused to do it. Which I always think is pretty entertaining when we refuse to do stuff. So the 11th step. When I am willing to practice the 11th step, as it's outlined in the book, truly my day goes smoother. I access power and my day goes smoother. It just does. And I've had several experiences in terms of doing it directly out of the book and then also adding things to that and doing some different things. There's anything wrong with that. We don't want to be so dogmatic that we close ourselves up to other experiences in morning meditation and prayer and evening review. I think they're both vitally important however you do it. Or they have been for me. And again, something else that I have done, and I also encourage the women that I sponsor to do it in order to get in the habit, and is to do it, find somebody to do it with. And call them and get prayed up together. Review your day or your plans for the day together. Ask for guidance together. Sometimes they'll do that together in the morning and then they'll go sit quietly and then get back on the phone again and finish it up. Because it's asking you upon awakening. Now, upon awakening, I don't go through my entire plan for the day because I'm still just like fuzzy. But the first thing that I think about is God. My mind's just been trained up that way. That is the first thought that shows up. And I'll start praying and asking. And then I get up and then I do my formal praying and sitting. And sometimes I follow this to the T, and sometimes I'm just doing my own prayer stuff. But this pretty much covers it. Considering my plans for the day. Something that Bob Olson taught me and Gary Brown has reinforced that with me lately, is to make my plan for the day the night before. So when I go into prayer and meditation in the morning, I've got my plan already laid out. And I can tell you, it doesn't happen all the time, but my plans have been changed once I got into prayer. That has happened. Doesn't happen rarely, but it has happened. Where I have absolutely been guided in a different direction. But I'm basically asking for the power to meet my responsibilities for that day as God would have me. And I'm asking God to get me out of the way so I can do that. So I'm not totally consumed with myself. You know, we all talk about relationships and stuff, and it's true. I have defective relationships. And it's not just about with the person I'm romantically involved with. I have difficulty with relationships everywhere. Everywhere. At work, you know, at home, at play, in AA. So it's vitally important that I get connected with that. If you want to grow, actively participate in relationships. A lot of what we read in here, we turn that into prayer. A lot of what's said in here. Like it says, our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. We turn that into a prayer. Father, please, I ask that my thought life be placed on a much higher plane. I ask that my thinking be clear of wrong motives. And we just run through this and turn it all into a prayer. And then it asks us to, if I've got any problems, it's asking for specific direction. It's asking me to be quiet and to listen. It's asking me to go into meditation. It's telling me what to do throughout the day, which fits in nicely with the 10th step. if I get agitated or I'm not sure what to do, I'm doubtful, to pause, to ask for the right thought or action. I already know what the right thought or action is. God, please remove this. If I'm agitated, please remove this. I discuss it with somebody and make amends if I've caused harm. Then I resolutely turn my thoughts to someone else I can help. It's a great way if you are in the middle of an obsession of the mind, great way to treat obsession. If you've done the inventory, you've made the amends, start praying for other people. When I was going through my nasty little obsession I've had several, but I was told you got to train your brain, train it up. And what I thought was interesting was, okay, because I'd start obsessing, then I'd start feeling bad, and then I'd start nursing that, then I'd start thinking about this, then I'd start thinking about that, and it was just like this whirlwind of negativity, and I was starting to feel worse and worse by the moment. And I was told, train your brain, train up. When those thoughts occur, you immediately start praying for somebody else. Don't go down that road. So I said, okay, I was in enough pain. I was like, okay, I'll do it. And what was interesting is that stuff came up, and my absolute resistance to start praying, I was getting some kind of perverse enjoyment out of my pain and my obsession. I was absolutely enjoying it. Was getting something out of it. Did not want to get all prayed up about it. And there's, I like being a victim. I like being harmed. I like being wronged. I mean, all that stuff. It's crazy. But if you stay on the path, you're compelled to change regardless. So that does work. Start praying for other people.
Just anybody?
Well, I have plenty of people I can pray for. My guy, I pray for the people in my home group because they piss me off. That's not always true, but sometimes it is. Especially these young ones that are coming up, they've only been sober a couple years and they think they know something, and they're trying to tell me what to do. Oh, I get mad. And I've just gone through a recent experience with that and had to write some inventory on that. That was pretty fun. And then go make amends to them. But it's a good example that I walk what I talk. I can be wrong. They need to see that. It's important stuff. I kind of digressed, didn't I? I don't know where I started off. But to start praying for other people. And it talks about that. And if we have people that we want to meditate with to do that. Sometimes my husband and I pray together, sometimes we don't. It doesn't really matter to me. Sometimes I get together with people out of the blue and we just have a meditation together. Or we'll meet before home group and have a meditation together. I don't try to... Whatever, it just happens. Somebody will call it and we'll show up and do it. Going through the day and pausing. And saying to ourselves many times each day, thy will be done, not mine. Sometimes I'll set little reminders for myself for a period of time. A suggestion was made to me to get a toothpick, put a little white piece of paper on it, the surrender, and stick that on my desk, that just as a visual reminder to stay surrendered and to say that prayer. God, I pray that your will be done, not mine. But the promises here are very true. We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. And Roadrunner over there touched on it. I like excitement. Don used to say, I like things that go boom. I do. And I don't care if it's danger, excitement, or if it's I'm happy, and I just got something that's great and it's going my way, excitement. When I saw that, I'm in much less danger of excitement. For someone like me, that's key because I tend to go way out there with it. I don't stay here with it. It becomes everything. I have to be careful sometimes when I want something. I can get really excited about it, and then the anticipation of waiting. Am I going to get it? Am I not going to get it? And then I am in my head, and I cannot get out of my head, and I just start to go nuts waiting to hear the answer. Am I going to get it? Am I not going to get it? I really want it. And then I start becoming really attached to an outcome. And then, you know, if I don't get it, what is that called after a nuclear holocaust? The fallout is not pretty. You know what I mean? So I understand today why they say much less danger of excitement. You know, the stuff with fear, anger, worry, and self-pity and foolish decisions, that was pretty easy for me to grasp. Excitement, not so much. I didn't see what was so wrong with that. But now I understand. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily. And that is my experience too. I do a lot, but I have access to a lot of power. Don, you say all the time, make no mistake about it, this is about power. But it is not yours. It will flow through you and into the lives of others so you can be of service. Where my first primary purpose, place for me to be of service is in Alcoholics Anonymous. Then it's my family, then it's work. But I've been able to do a lot and have been given a lot of responsibility. And I think it's because of this, my willingness to be an open channel. And hopefully that channel will just continue to get wider and wider. When I look at my heroes in AA, like Don and Tom Ivester, who you guys are having out here, and I hope you guys get to spend some time with him. Mary knows him. Incredible man. You want to talk about some power. And I want what he has. I want to do what he has done. He has accomplished some amazing things in his life. And he's got access to tremendous amounts of power. I can only hope to be as busy and being of service to other people as he is in my lifetime. I'll probably barely touch it. Barely touch it. That's why I think having our heroes and our messengers in AA is so important, those people that are out there along the path way ahead of us, way down the road, because it's a clear road for us to travel. And I want what those people have. So, and they are busy, busy people. Busy people. You know, Tom, for those of you that don't know Tom, Tom is an incredibly busy man. Not once have I called him and he hasn't called me back or answered the phone directly and then spent time with me on the phone. And I'm nothing special. I hear he does that with everybody. And he's busy. So I know he's got access to power. I know he does. So, and then the stuff that we review at night, and it's been talked about. Not once have I gone through these questions at night. Let me tell you this, by the way. I used to think this was backwards on the 11th step. I'm like, why don't they put awakening first and then retiring at night last? This makes no sense. This is one of the things I wanted to rewrite in the big book. Because it didn't make sense.